tree. You know?
Which one?
He owns the Washington Post.
Does he?
Which is
really?
One of the most revered news outlets in the country.
Huh.
And it is owned by
probably won't
the
be
man who almost owns the internet. Like 50% of the internet traffic goes through Amazon. Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that either.
So like that's a sleeping giant. That
I don't think you'll be reading this
enough.
Article on the Washington Post.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Well, oh, yeah, man. He's got. Yeah, unless you believe the conspiracy theories, they say maybe Vladimir Putin's got more money.
Oh,
but of official record, Jeff Bezos tops the list.
At least of Americans.
Bill Gates. Yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's crazy to think that he owns a newspaper, a media outlet that's supposed to be objective and fair and balanced, and yet it clearly, when put to the test, op-ed, you know, articles, and they're constantly side with the ownership side of things, management sides of things.
All right, well. It is now, unfortunately, 6:30,
wow,
but we started
speeds.
The news came into our time by 3 minutes, so I think that we actually get to recover our 3 minutes now, and we did promise that we would talk about people who voted for Donald Trump, people who were, as I believe I heard, duped.
Yeah, I think duped, swindled, conned, any of those terms work pretty well for, I mean, obviously there's definitely a contingent of people out there who knew exactly what they were voting for and chose to cast that vote. But I think likely a large portion, if not a majority of people who voted for Mr. Trump in the general election did so because they were convinced of things that he may have, you know, some lies that he may have spewed on the campaign trail that they bought into and didn't bother to look anywhere past the sheen of, you know, him being a reality TV star,
right.
them seeing him on the TV, you know.
Yeah, right. Oh, I know that fella.
I seen him on the TV.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so, you know, it's shocking considering what we're seeing the Trump administration, you know, with this NLRB stuff that we've been talking about and all the other attacks on organized labor and on workers in general, such as trying to pass a national right to work act, that folks who are unionized workers in this country would support that man. But, you know, as it turns out, 37% of union members and 37% of union members voted for Donald Trump in the general election against
right.
Hillary Clinton, and 52% majority of white union households voted for Trump. So, you know, as we know, that the majority of Trump supporters were white people. And so it's not surprising that if a large portion of unionized workers voted for him, that the majority of those people would be white workers. But it's, you know, it's one thing to have that abstract and know that. It's another thing to see the actual hard and fast numbers.
Right.
And realize that these are workers that are presumably still in unions, you know, now a year later.
Sure.
And are feeling the pinch that his administration is, you know, feeling the effects that his anti-worker, anti-labor policies are having on their workplace, on their livelihoods.
Right.
And I wonder if some of those workers out there regret that decision or if they recognize the connections at all.
Right.
Paying attention.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of bad going on. I'll give this to the man. He did withdraw us from the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
That is true.
And that thing was going to be a catastrophe. But you know who else would have? Bernie Sanders would have.
It's true. And, you know, he withdrew us from the TPP, but at the same time, this tax bill that he's championing and that they're pushing forward
it's gonna
is going to
be the greatest transfer of wealth
yeah.
ever in the history of ever.
I mean, our economy is going to be shifted so dramatically that we're not even going to recognize it 10 years from now. But that is, you know, I guess that's a discussion for next month's episode because we are about 15 seconds out here.
We should talk about that. All right. Well, yeah we're brushing up now on 6:33. So I guess that brings us to an end for the night. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Appreciate having you here. And thanks to the person who called in.
Yeah. I'm Michael Cathcart.
Nick Bubb.
Thanks for listening. Have a good night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. Coming to you from the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. On Friday, December 15th, the Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights for the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, Professor Philip Alston, delivered his report on the United States. He conducted a fact-finding visit to the United States recently at the invitation of the White House. Alston's report was scathing. Unfortunately, because it was released on a Friday afternoon 10 days before Christmas, that report didn't get the attention it deserved. So, on this edition of Prison Pipeline, we're going to hear part of that report from the Special Rapporteur. Here's Philip Alston.
The context, as you know, of course, is that the U.S. Congress is trying desperately to pass a tax bill which, if adopted, would represent the single most dramatic increase in inequality that could be imagined. At the same time, and partly in order to fund that tax reform, the administration has indicated very clearly that it plans to embark on major welfare reform and healthcare reform. That means, and that is focused specifically on making large savings. In other words, cutting significant number of programs. The basic thrust of my report is that the combination of these different reform efforts would fundamentally transform the situation here in the United States. The social safety net that currently exists in terms of the social welfare system is riddled with holes. It is a very partial, poorly funded, and certainly far from comprehensive approach to ensuring social protection. But if the cuts that are anticipated are made, it will essentially be blown apart. I met with various state health authorities, and in any state that had taken the Medicaid expansion, I said, what would the consequences be of a rollback of the expansion program or a reduction in the overall program? And curiously, I don't think they'd all been in touch with one another and exchanged notes, but they all used the word devastating to describe the impact that it would have on their ability to provide even basic access to healthcare for the bottom 20 or 30% of the population. That's a terrible prospect, and it's one that I think should be given very, very careful consideration by lawmakers and others when considering the best ways forward to achieve the various goals that need to be balanced. In the statement that I'm releasing today, which is quite detailed, I make the point that the United States is clearly one of the richest countries in the world, that it clearly has levels of technological and other innovation that are the envy of all, that its people have a work ethic which is extraordinary. But coupled with all those achievements are the statistics which are pretty well known, I think, at least to the international community, that the US infant mortality rate is the highest in the developed world, that Americans can expect to live shorter and sicker lives than in any other rich democracy, that inequality levels are already higher than in most European countries, that neglected tropical diseases are making a comeback, hookworm in Alabama in the 21st century. I saw some wonderful straight piping systems, as they're called in Alabama. In other words, sewage flows out into the garden and cesspools form around houses. But the governments in the states where this happens see no responsibility to be providing basic sanitation and water systems to all of their people. It's a luxury. They can pay for it themselves if they're able to. The youth poverty rate in the US is the highest across the OECD, the Rich Countries Club. The US ranks 35th out of 37 in the OECD in terms of poverty and inequality. I could go on. The point is a simple one, that the contrast between the way in which those in the bottom 20% of the population exist is in dramatic contrast to the wealth that is in the country and is being further exacerbated by current trends. In the report, I asked the question, who are the poor? And I ask that question not because I'm an academic and want to get off on not very interesting topics, but because what I've seen in the US is the dominance of twin narratives, which are that the rich are enterprising, altruistic, hardworking, dedicated. The poor are losers, scammers, people trying to profit from the system. And that narrative sort of frames the issues and is put forward by politicians to, on the one hand, justify massive tax reductions and thus immense transfers to the rich, combined with massive cuts in the basic assistance provided to the poor. My argument, predictably, is that if we take human rights seriously, not just rights that American governments contest, unfortunately, such as the right to health care, or the right to housing, or the right to adequate food, but civil and political rights, those rights cannot be enjoyed effectively in situations where there is massive inequality. Poor people have no chance of having their voices heard, no chance of influencing public policy. And that's pretty much what we see happening in the United States. There's also a racial dimension to a lot of this. The image that is in the minds of many of the politicians that I've heard is a lazy black family living high on the hog, as we say. Color TV set, smartphones, and lazing around all day. The reality, of course, is that poverty is by no means predominantly black. Poverty has all faces, including my own. White people live in extreme poverty in many parts of this country. And so the racial narrative, which is designed to appeal to certain groups, is then often used precisely to punish those who have fallen for that narrative, because the welfare cuts are not just for black people. The welfare cuts are for everyone, and those people are suffering in the United States today. I won't go through in detail the report that I've presented, but I want to pick out a couple of issues which I think are particularly important. First, I believe that current trends in the United States are actually undermining democracy. Democracy is the foundation stone upon which this country is built, the contribution of which it has been most proud internationally. And yet what we see are the lowest voter turnouts in any developed country. We see overt efforts to disenfranchise people, anyone who's been in prison, people who still have court debt and so on, are deprived of the vote. And that is a massive number of people in the world's greatest incarcerator. We see covert efforts to disenfranchise through the imposition of voter ID requirements that are not related in any way to actual problems that have been experienced. We see the manipulation of polling station locations. We see the relocating of DMVs, Departments of Motor Vehicles, away from areas where poor voters live, just in case they might be able to get an ID. And we see the imposition of growing costs to the whole business of actually registering and being able to vote. The result is a huge disenfranchisement of the people who are hit the hardest by the political system. I also look at the report at a number of issues that are commonly brought up in the context of justifying welfare reform. And I'll just take a couple of examples. One is that what we need to do is to move people from welfare to work. It's absolutely true. There is nothing more important than work. And those who are capable of working should, and in this country, I believe, want to work. But the reality is that the United States has, for many years now, been a country in which there is a plentiful supply of labor, but simply not a sufficient demand. Trends in terms of automation, robotization, self-driving cars, whatever, are all exacerbating that. And the jobs that the politicians say they want to encourage people to take are often not out there. There are no well-funded, well-resourced retraining programs that address the social problems that people have. The reasons why they are not employed are multiple. Many have disabilities, many have criminal convictions, which makes it almost impossible then to get a job or to get housing or do anything else. Many are aging, and I don't mean people in their 60s, they might be aging at 40. Others have lived lives doing hard manual labor and are not up for strenuous jobs anymore. The problem is that to talk about getting people off the welfare rolls and into employment is usually just a rhetorical one to justify cutting welfare rolls. Linked to that is the question of fraud. There is a very curious disconnect between the way in which we treat fraud at the top and the way in which we treat it at the bottom. For quite a few years now, there have been efforts to decrease the staff and funds available to the Internal Revenue Service, the one that investigates fraud by the wealthy in terms of tax evasion. Reduce the funds. Cut their ability. It contrasts dramatically with the rhetoric that I've heard from many government officials that we need to step up efforts to root out fraud in the welfare system. And yet the most egregious examples of fraud that I've seen in the welfare system come from large-scale providers and businesses and not from individuals who are drawing benefits to which they're not entitled. I've been given no evidence of large-scale fraud, and yet it drives policy in this area.
You are listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. We're listening to a report by Philip Alston, Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights for the UN's Human Rights Council. In addition to his work with the OHCHR and the Human Rights Council, Philip Alston is a professor at New York University's School of Law. He's a human rights advocate and an expert on international law. Much of what Professor Alston had to say will not come as a great surprise to loyal listeners. You know already that, unfortunately, our society tends to rely on law enforcement to deal with people who are unhoused, with people who use drugs in public or in a problematic way, and with people who have issues with mental illness. You know that our criminal justice system, like so many other aspects of our society, is fundamentally, both racially and economically, biased, such that people who are not white and people who are poor do not get treated fairly. Professor Alston conducted a tour of the U.S. for the Human Rights Council recently, compiling evidence and preparing a scathing report to the UN Human Rights Council that examines, from a human rights perspective, the growing levels of poverty and inequity in our country. In particular, he noted that here in the U.S., we have made things worse by effectively criminalizing poverty. Let's get back to Professor Alston.
The final issue that I will talk about here, but my report is much more extensive, is what's called the criminalization of poverty. It has a number of dimensions. First is the obvious one, where you make it a crime to be homeless. If you are sleeping on the street, if you are sitting on the street, it's a crime in many jurisdictions. If you urinate in the street, it's a crime. And we might well think that it should be, because it's most unpleasant. But in cities which determinedly provide no public toilets, what do we expect? What would most of us do? It's a crime. Once you are charged with one of those crimes, a fine is imposed, but you're homeless and penniless. So the fine that you don't pay increases dramatically because the courts have linked all sorts of fees to it additionally. And so a $100 parking ticket or a $100 infraction for doing something as a homeless person can blossom very quickly into the thousands. That person is then guilty of a misdemeanor and will be imprisoned. Then they're really into the great circle. They come out, they still don't have a home, they have a criminal record, they can't get any help. We add to that then often the suspension of driver's licenses, not just for driving offences, but for a great array of offences, failure to pay fines. So in cities, and most of the American cities that I've seen have either no or very poor public transportation, what you do to the poor is to take away their driver's license, their only possible way to earn a living. And again, the spiral downwards is fueled by public policy. In a number of cities, I have seen firsthand what I would call the Ferguson dynamic. In Ferguson, the Justice Department did a detailed report that showed that the real problem was that the police force were primarily a revenue collection agency. And the more people they could ticket for whatever offences, the better off the city would be. No police department, certainly not in Ferguson, but anywhere, targets the well-off because they can fight back. They target the easy victims. They pick up the poor. They levy endless fines. There will be no political pushback. And so what we see in many municipalities around the country is that the costs of justice and indeed of other public services are actually being put onto the backs of the poor, because the criminal justice system is overwhelmingly for the poor. The rich avoid it. The rich can pay their way out through lawyers, through defense, through other means, and don't have to suffer it. The poor are stuck. Finally, in terms of criminalization, you've got the system of bail bonds, which is truly disgraceful. It only exists in one other country in the world. And what it means is that if a person is arrested for no matter how minor a crime, they go before a judge and the judge sets bail. The trend has been for judges to set relatively high bails, but even a $1,000 bail, which would be stunningly low, is an impossibility for a homeless person. And so what happens is you can't pay your $1,000 bail, off to prison. If you had a home, you lose it. If you had a job, you lose it. If you had a family, you're alienated. Totally counterproductive policy, but one driven by economic objectives. And at the back of all this are the bail bond companies, which generally charge around 10% non-refundable immediately. So if you get a $50,000 bond, you've got to come up with $5,000, which disappears. And I heard of many cases where the charges were actually dropped 2 days later. That $5,000 is down the drain. And if the prosecutor decided to reinstate other charges, sorry, your $5,000's gone, that'll be a new bond, please, another $5,000. And if people are living in poverty or close to the borderline, this breaks their backs. I'll leave it at that. My report deals with a range of other issues: the gender dimensions of poverty, racism, disability, privatization, environmental degradation. It's wide-ranging. I mean, what I note in my statement is that there were good things and bad things. the bad things, if you're walking on Skid Row in Los Angeles, hundreds of encampments, people living in truly grim situations. If you're in San Francisco and you see people being, as I did directly, being moved on by the police constantly. One woman was with a couple of others and she obviously knew the cop because it's a sort of regular beat. And she said, but where should I go? And he said, I don't know where you can go, but then what can I do? I don't know, just move on. And that sort of futility is pretty distressing. One of the realizations that I had during the mission, which was something of an awakening for me, is that when people who are middle class encounter homeless people, they are offended. Their senses are offended by the smell, by the appearance, by the inconvenience, etc. Mm-hmm. And they tend then to be both contemptuous and resentful. The hell are you doing here? Get out of my neighborhood. And what suddenly occurred to me is that, in fact, when we have that encounter, we should actually be reflecting on ourselves and saying, so is this the society? Is this the community? Is this the government that is doing this? In a country like the United States, homelessness could be eliminated very quickly. It's not, because we don't want to put the money into it. We want to see these people as losers. We want to see them as low forms of life. We don't want to acknowledge that in all of our own families, there are people who have immense challenges and who are not able to make it entirely on their own. And if you've been a veteran, there were very high numbers of veterans on the street, traumatized, not fitting in on the street. Surely it's the obligation of society to ensure basic good treatment.
Well, there you have it. You have just heard Professor Philip Alston. He's the Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights for the UN Human Rights Council and the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights. He was discussing the growing levels of poverty and inequity in the United States and the ways that we have accelerated and exacerbated these disparities by, among other things, criminalizing poverty. Professor Alston's complete written statement is available on the web at ohchr.org. It's quite detailed and well worth a read. You can find a lot of very informative materials on that website as well, including Professor Alston's full report when it's completed. And for now, that's it. You have been listening to Prison Pipeline. Thank you for joining us. You can find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline at the KBOO website at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. I want to thank Professor Philip Alston and the UN's Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights and the Human Rights Council. A heartfelt thank you to our engineers Danielle Parks and Mike Fataklis for all their help. And thanks especially to you, dear listener, for joining us. You make it all worth it. I'm Doug McVeigh. Good night.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes